Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Impactful Innovations podcast with JJ Snow. You're about to join JJ for another insightful, uplifting discussion with innovators who seek to make the world a better place and are led by their hearts to take on some of the toughest challenges facing humanity. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Impactful Innovations, the podcast that's all about inspiring innovations and uplifting conversations. I am your tech-friendly host, JJ Snow, and wow, what a season we have ahead of us. Kicking off our first season and our very first episode, no pressure, Sam, is Sam Burcham, CEO of 1.1, one of the most advanced indoor farming systems in the world. Sam and his brother John came to the U.S. all the way from Victoria, Australia to play Division I collegiate tennis and attend Santa Clara University. Sam has a passion for engineering and robotics, receiving a bachelor's in mechanical engineering and a master's in robotics and mechatronics. Sam also participated in the development of an autonomous marine vessel, as well as an omnidirectional robot, drawing inspiration from this work to found his current mission, to nourish the 1.1 billion people who began this millennium hungry. That's an incredible mission. Today, we're going to explore the future of agricultural technology, robotics and automation, plant-based foods and medicines, and even more. Sam, welcome to the show. We are really, really excited to have you join us. And I know our mentor project students and teachers around the world are looking forward to this episode.
JJ, I am ready to go. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about, you know, your passion for engineering and ag tech and robotics. Where did that start? Did that start when you were a kid? Was that something that somebody in your life inspired you to begin exploring? What's your origin story?
Sure. So we, brother and myself, obviously born in Melbourne, Victoria. We played tennis from a very, very early age, played up through our high school and managed to get scholarships over here to the United States. My brother, who is far smarter than I am, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a minute, he came over here, did his undergraduate work in chemical physics, that was pre-med, got a huge MCAT score. Then he went to Munich to do power engineering and then won the Hyperloop competition at SpaceX and was the first propulsion engineer at Lilium Vertical Takeoff and Landing Aviation Company. So that was all before the age of 24. And I was twiddling my thumbs over here in the United States. But I came, played my years out at Santa Clara University. I was the captain there for 2 years. And basically, hopefully this will be a theme for the podcast today, but really it was me just prodding the universe. There wasn't sort of some grand plan that I had, you know, I wasn't in this constant state of execution against that plan. It was more or less just, I'm going to put my foot in the door. I'm going to work hard. I mean, rather than sort of being stunned by analysis paralysis, let's just keep looking forward and making the best decisions you possibly can in the moment, which is somewhat of a life habit of mine now. But you know, when I started engineering, this is how it all began. I came from a different school. I came to Santa Clara. They admitted me to the Life and Sciences department, but I really wanted to be in engineering. So in the middle of summer, I walked into the engineering school and met with the associate dean, made it up to the dean's office, and I just said, look, I don't have a background in engineering. I don't have a background in math or physics. I haven't even taken a physics class in my life, but I guarantee you I am going to graduate with my engineering degree in 3 years rather than four. And for whatever reason, they heard that and managed to admit me in my first quarter over to engineering school. Countless more stories along that line of just, you know, failure, push past it. But really it was just a constant story of, I suppose, very, very good fortune and hard work to accompany it. And ended up with a mechanical engineer's degree and moved into my master's in robotics. And halfway through my master's in robotics, started 1.1.
That's fantastic. Okay, so let me just touch on something, because this is common to a lot of innovators and successful entrepreneurs that I've met. They see those failures, the negatives that happen, as guideposts that are kind of, you know, pointing them along the pathway, and they turn it into positives. And it sounds like you did that too. And that's in large part what drives much of their success. Would you say that that's also been your experience?
I think so. I mean, a lot of this came from sport. What's great about sport is that in no uncertain terms, you're told very regularly, you lose.
Right.
You lose. You are not the best. But you, if you want to be the best, it is up to you. It's not up to your coach. It's not up to the government. It's not up to anyone else. It's up to you. And I think that's sort of translating that over from the sport world is really important. And to anyone who eventually listens to this, it's that same idea. You are going to fail all the time, but who cares? Who cares? You're not defined by your failures. You're going to be defined by your successes. So I think it is a very common trait, I would say, amongst entrepreneurs, which is you know you're going to fail. I mean, this is what we brought into the start of this business, and I've said this from the beginning. I personally am 100% sure we are going to succeed, and I really mean that. That is my mindset. I'm not tricking myself. I really believe I'm 100% sure we're going to succeed. But what I'm also 100% sure of is that there will be countless roadblocks in the way and walls and thorn bushes and cloudy days. But who cares? If you already know that you're going to succeed, everything that hits you along the way is just a speed bump rather than a blocker.
Oh, yeah. See, I love that. I love, love, love that because, again, it's the mindset, putting yourself in that positive mindset, looking at those negatives, those friction points, and turning them into, okay, got it. I learned from it. Now on to what's next. And yes, this is it's such an important message because so many people that I've seen that have been successful in translating technologies in meaningful ways, ways that are socially impactful at a global level, have this same mindset. So thanks for sharing that. That's huge.
Sure. So, I think mindset is massive. There's this one Jocko Willink quote that I love, which is, you know, whenever anything bad happens, just say, good. Bring it on. Yes. I don't care. Throw it at me. Throw it at me again. Throw it at me seven times. I don't care. Good. Bring it. Move on. The mindset is so important because if you don't have that, you will be beaten to death starting a business.
I agree. Oh my gosh. That's tremendous. So let's take the mindset and talk about this mission. 1.1 billion people, food insecurity is a major challenge globally right now. What prompted you to tackle this specific area? And it's such a massive challenge. Yet, based on our discussions, I feel like you're in the right place and you're moving very quickly forward towards what I think will be a big success for us in the next 5 to 10 years. Can you talk about what inspired you to tackle that particular mission? And then what you see with the technologies you're working with today as bringing this to a successful manifestation?
Sure. Yeah. I think, so if we go right down to the base of why this all began, John and I, you know, relatively interested in stoicism. And basically what that teaches you is there are some things in your control and out of your control. And what we saw was, and it's related to this, was you only have one shot at the plate with your life. You've got one shot. So why not take the biggest swing you possibly can at the biggest ball you can possibly find? Why not? And this is Hillel the Elder, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? Really, really important, irrefutable statement. So we realized that. And then we set about trying to find those problems and feasible solutions. You know, interstellar travel, for example. You know, John and I aren't going to invent warp drive in the next 3 years. It has to be something.
I love it. You're speaking my language. This is awesome.
Well, I know you're developing warp drive, but I'm a couple of years behind you there, JJ. I know you're way ahead. But we looked at transportation, big problem. We looked at energy. We looked very, very closely at liquid salt reactors, nuclear power. We can dive into that at any length, but we came across the statistic that 1.1 billion people began this millennium malnourished. And we just sat on it. And when you consider just for a moment an individual person who would be suffering to that extent, and then you multiply that by 3x the population of the United States, you start to get a magnitude. Now, at that magnitude, my puny human brain has no idea how to contextualize it, but I know I contextualize something at the individual scale. And so that was the moment we knew, you know, we have to do something to do with food and nourishment, because what I can say, I said it back then and I'll say it today with the same fervor, the number one problem we face today is malnourishment. It is the number one problem on earth. Yes, we have climate change. We have a variety of other issues on a global scale. But today, this very second, 821 million people do not have steady access to food, somewhere between malnourished and starving. And 2.2 billion people at the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum are eating too much of the wrong thing. Mm. And so it is really that is the ball. That is the ball that is coming towards us at the plate. It was the biggest ball. It's coming the fastest. And that is the ball that we said we were going to take a swing at.
So this is really exciting because it sounds like you settled on this as your problem. This is our mission. This is what we want to do. Mm-hmm. Now tell me how, so you found a number of technologies, some that you and John had both had experience with. How did you go about selecting the right technologies? Because a lot of the areas that are struggling with food insecurity today, they're austere areas. They don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of resources. So you had to be really mindful of that as well. What were some of the calculations that went into which technologies would be a best fit for solving this problem? And then why did you choose them? Why did you think they'd be successful in solving this problem?
Very good. I mean, so we... From a high level, we were thinking such a problem does not get solved in 3 years. And this is something we say to all of our investors. If you're looking for, you know, a traditional VC deal with a 5 to 7 year fund, we're not that deal. Nothing against those deals. We're just not that deal. And so we've been able to accumulate a really nice list of investors. But when thinking about this problem, it's going to take a while. And so we looked at traditional farming. You know, it predates civilization. It's 10,000 years old or older. And many of the techniques we use today are of that same generation, unfortunately. You know, agriculture has come a long way, you know, have no illusions. But we didn't see how my background in robotics and his background in power engineering would make a significant impact on outdoor farming in the short term. And when I'm talking short term, I mean like 10 to 20 years. That's short term with respect to humanity. Then we looked at greenhouse farming. Greenhouse farming is the process of growing plants inside of a room that has a transparent roof. In other words, the sunlight can get through. Now, the Dutch over in the Netherlands have nailed that. They are the second largest exporter of food based on value in the world. The Dutch.
Incredible.
Because they have nailed greenhouse technology. So we, again, couldn't see how we could really push the ball down the field or hit that ball for a home run. But then we came across vertical farming. Vertical farming is, again, the process of cultivating plants indoors. But rather than using sunlight, you use LED light. And that may sound like a relatively, you know, minimal step forward, but it's a massive step function change in your ability to control that plant's experience of life. And what does that control enable you to do? It enables you to grow a much wider variety of crops in a much more repeatable fashion. And that's really important in the long term. Yes, there are detractors left, right, and center talking about vertical farming. And this is not a me versus them story whatsoever, but there are detractors left and right saying, you know, vertical farming, the cost of production is too high. You need to use LED lights. You're inside of urban real estate. You'll never get the economics down low enough. But their perspective is not long-term enough. Their perspective is, let's look 2 or 3 years into the future and we'll see if New York has a couple of these. We're talking long-term. So we came across vertical farming. And once you start to analyze the asymptote of production price, in other words, how low can you get the production price when you start to make assumptions about the cost of electricity, cost of labor, extent of automation, these kinds of things, you can get the price of production down very, very low. And so what that enables to do is to feed the mass market. Now, what we also did was, this is about the 1.1, is it not? This is why we got into this game. And we didn't, feeding the high per capita GDP nations is one of the stepping stones to the end goal. So don't think that we're going to stop there.
Right.
How we get to the end goal is really twofold. The first is, this system is basically what you would call a high throughput phenotyping system. In other words, you can take many different varieties of plants, make them available to many different types of environments and see how they grow using a high level of data analytics. What this allows us to do is to perform crop science and hybridization much, much faster than you can outside. And this allows us to look at a much wider variety of crops, put them together genetically and see how they perform. Cutting to the chase, The goal, one of the goals, key goals of this technology is to use it to discover the crops that grow in brackish water.
So cool.
You can discover a plant that grows in brackish water, the Middle East turns green.
Right.
Africa around its edges can turn green. And this is when we can enable people to feed themselves. And that's the point at which, and the macro goal for John and me is the per capita GDP of the continent of Africa is mirrors the per capita GDP of that of North America and Europe. Imagine the world if that was true. And so that's the macro. That's the before I'm dead, did I have an impact on it? That's yeah. the macro question, and food is one piece of that.
That's incredible. And so I'm just so intrigued because a lot of countries are using desalinization techniques to get the fresh water they need, but it sounds like you've been able to solve that dealing with brackish water within the technologies that you're bringing into play here. Is that right?
So brackish water is a solution that we are going to solve in the medium to long term. We have to be very, very focused in the short term to develop the core technology first. It's a very hard problem to solve, is the automation of the production of plants indoors. Really hard. I mean, you can imagine how hard it is to mass produce something, but once that thing is a biological entity, genetically different from its brothers and sisters, it's very, very, very difficult. So that's what we have to focus on in the short term. But what we understand when we look at greenhouses and other high throughput phenotyping systems are these capabilities. And when you take a small scale high throughput phenotyping system and then deploy it at our scale, mm-hmm. that's when you start to run into the data sets that can solve that problem.
So let's talk about that. What kind of scale are we looking at here? Because many people, when I talk to them, they think about a vertical farming as, oh, this is something you do in your garage or a cargo container. It's not going to scale really well. Let's talk about that because it sounds like you have a solution for scaling it up to a level where you could support even an entire city.
Oh, absolutely. And we are a piece of the puzzle. We are a piece of the puzzle, very much so in the short term. In the longer term, it's a different game. But in the short term, we're very much a piece of the puzzle. We are cultivating a specific set of crops that the other cultivation methods struggle to cultivate. So greenhouses and traditional farms don't produce them that well or don't produce them year round. That's where vertical farms fit in the short term. But believe me, you know, looking at a $27 billion market here in the United States alone for leafy greens and small vegetables, that's still going to be significant scale. You know, the same was said about tomatoes. 20, 25 years ago, people were saying, why on earth would you ever grow a tomato indoors? Lo and behold, today, 70% of tomatoes in North America are grown indoors. So, you know, it's a very similar analogy that you can map onto vertical farming, and it will occur over time. It'll take a lot of capital and it'll take a lot of time. You can think of this as an infrastructure play almost. You know, we're redefining that infrastructure in cities to be able to feed people. But the way you reach scale is through modularity, and that's what we designed into the system from the word go, so that over time, if we want to deploy something that produces 100,000 pounds per year or 10 million pounds per year, we can just basically, like Lego blocks, put these facilities together to produce the variety of crops that we so wish.
So let's talk a little bit about the robots and the automation that you're bringing into this particular play, because that got me excited. The fact that you can now cultivate entire crops remotely and do it so very efficiently, and you don't even have to have people, you know, hands-on in that space. And especially now in the middle of a pandemic, these are kinds of questions. How do we protect people from spreading, you know, germs and diseases, to how do we, you know, appropriately maintain large scale crops, but do it in such an efficient way where we've got the sensors, so we're picking it at, you know, the peak time for shipping or the peak time of ripeness. And that becomes even more critical when you start to talk about pharmaceuticals and plant-based growing for pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
But let's talk about some of the sensors and robotics that you're bringing to bear, because those were fascinating when we discussed them before.
Sure. So key to that modularity point I was speaking about a minute ago is your ability to automate these functions. You can see Tesla trying to do this with the automated production of a car. So that's key to all of this. So start with the plant. What does the plant need? Well, the plant needs light, specific kinds of light, specific intensities, and this varies for each crop. The plant needs nutrients. The plant needs water. The plant needs to perform gaseous exchange for transpiration and respiration. So you need to be able to provide all of the environmental factors that the plant desires. And because we're indoors and because we control it, we can give the plant exactly what it wants. So step two, after you've given the plant its environmental factors, logistically, how do you deal with the plant inside of your facility? Because you have to seed the plant into a growth medium. You have to germinate the plant. You have to put that plant through adolescence. You have to re-space the plant on its growth medium as it grows larger and larger to make sure that you're using your light optimally. You have to harvest the plant. There are all these functions or different steps that the plant has to go through in order to be able to cultivate. How do you automate those functions most efficiently with the highest amount of redundancy? As in, you know, if something goes wrong, making sure that there is another subsystem behind it to come in and back that system up if something were to fail, because plants don't like being without water for very long. That's no surprise to anyone. So what we developed were a fleet of robots. A fleet of robots that can perform a very, very wide variety of functions inside of this facility. And these functions that would be traditionally performed by human beings can be done in such a repeatable way that we decrease shrinkage, we decrease pest and disease infestation, and most importantly, when it comes to scale, decrease cost. And so if you can imagine, you just imagine now a big box inside of a warehouse. So you're inside of a warehouse and you've got the warehouse is 40 foot tall and you've got a 35 foot tall box. So you imagine that box, and then on the top of that box are a fleet of robots that run around the facility that automate the function of the facility. Inside of that box are the towers and towers of plants that are being grown inside of a controlled environment. So these, we grow with a cultivation technique that is vertical plane aeroponics. Vertical plane speaks to the orientation of the growth plane. Put simply, we grow out of walls. So if you've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, that monolith, they're all playing on that on Earth. Imagine a monolith with plants growing out of either side with the roots growing into that internal volume where we're irrigating them. Aeroponics is the form of irrigation. Aeroponics is when you cultivate the plants by spraying a nutrient-infused mist into the root zone. And that's what the root, that's what the plants get hydrated from, and that's where the plants acquire their nutrients. So the robots that run around the top of the facility can reach down into that big box we were talking about and pick up the plants inside of their grow boards, pick up these plants, relocate them to different environments and different temperatures and different lights. The robots can also inspect these plants. The robots can also move the lights. The robots can also perform maintenance functions. So because it's fleet robotics, we can achieve this kind of scale at a low cost. And because within each of these robots, there can be a different payload, a payload to move the plants, a payload to see the plants, we can be extremely modular. And that's what allows us to operate these facilities in such an automated fashion. And it allows us really to scale these facilities whilst also centralizing the high-skilled labor, the super intelligent growers and plant scientists, horticulturalists that that make all of this possible.
And Sam, I know one of the hopes that you have besides feeding 1.1 billion people is also providing medicines. Can you touch a little bit on that? Because that was very exciting for me to hear about. And it's something that, you know, many of the countries that I've been deployed to in my military service, that was an area that they struggled in consistently. It sounds like being able to set up, you know, a vertical farm where people are employing a lot of the methodologies that are in development right now could help them also fill this need for a medicinal supply as well at the local to national level.
Yeah, exactly. Super duper important. And that's something that COVID has kind of raised up higher on the list of priorities for many a nation. I think it's important to step back and talk about the mission of the business and the mission statement of our organization, which is 1.1 intends to build the largest network of autonomous indoor farms in the world to grow the food, to grow the medicines, and to discover the genetics to nourish and heal 1.1 billion people. And we're not going to stop until that occurs. There is nothing else that I would prefer to do with my time than to find a solution to that problem and to achieve that mission. And believe me, if we get there, we're not going to slow down. So that's the mission of the business, and that's what this technology is really capable of. And we start with food, then we move into biopharmaceuticals, and then we move into that huge plant science domain. So phase one is food, as we've discussed up until this point, but phase two is really biopharmaceuticals. What is that? You can grow pharmaceutical grade medicines and vaccines inside of plants. Now, the mechanism to be able to grow these medicines and vaccines is just pure magic. You can basically take a plant and you can hijack its internal biological operations, and you can train that plant to produce a pharmaceutical grade medicine or vaccine. And what is the extent of this? By the way, it's coming up to a $350 billion market cap here at the end of the middle of the decade. But this can produce a medicine, a treatment for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It can do it for eczema. It can do it for breast cancer. It can do it for brain tumors. A very, very wide variety of medicines can be produced inside of these plants. And then something that hits close to home, these plants can produce COVID-19 vaccines. Oh, right now, inside of a plant, there is a phase 3 COVID-19 vaccine up in Canada that's about to be pushed through phase 3 and into the mass market. I mean, it is just magical. So when you think about the what a plant is actually doing and really what our farms are doing, think about this as a molecular printer. In fact, the woman who discovered CRISPR, she said molecules are the new microchip. And just let that sink in. That is a massive statement. And I, of course, I believe it to be true. But when we're printing plants for food, we're printing, you know, those micro and macronutrients that we need to survive. That is, those are the molecules that we are printing. When we're getting to the medicines and the vaccines, that's when we get to the sort of the other end of the spectrum. We're printing these highly effective molecules that can be put into the human body to solve issues that other drugs cannot solve. So our goal with this is to get this technology to a point where medicines and vaccines are being grown inside of these facilities around the world. Every nation has their own manufacturing capability for their for all of the diseases that they wish to treat. And the major benefit of this is that because the unit economics are so much better than that of a traditional, you know, CHO cell production facility, these nations can afford to put these facilities on home soil and produce the medicines that they need to keep their populations well.
That's incredible. I had no idea about the COVID being grown inside the plant. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Astonishing.
Yeah, it really is. And this is what it just impresses me so much. I mean, ag tech is moving so fast forward, and I just see it as such a positive for the future right now. It gives me a lot of hope for all of these different areas and regions that I've been to that are struggling, in that we can really see some significant advances in the next 10 to 20 years. So as you're looking out, you know, what do you hope to be able to achieve in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, on this quest towards the 1.1?
The next 5 years are really focused on food and economics and operational efficacy, building these facilities very, very quickly, getting them operational swiftly, and having them be reliable in their production of plant material. And that plant material is originally going to be food. Now, that short term, we're going to build facilities out in the United States, build facilities in Europe, the UAE, Southeast Asia, these kinds of places where we can grow a reliable supply of produce that they would otherwise not have access to and sell that through e-commerce channels. So that's phase one. And in 5 years, we hope to be at least on 4 different continents, at least. Of course, Australia is included.
Right.
But after that, once we have had the time and the ability to get this technology and a number of medicines and vaccines through the regulatory process, which is strict for good reason, we can start to develop these, build these facilities around the world. So I would say in 5 years, you're going to see us in 4 continents growing food. I would say in 10 years, you're going to see us in 4 continents growing medicines. And in 20 years, I would say every single continent will have their own ability to produce foods and medicines for their nation. And, you know, when we get to the 20-year scale, you can start to make some fun assumptions about the cost of electricity, the cost of real estate, the level of automation, the development of biologics or biopharmaceutical products, excuse me. Then you can really start to dive in to think we could cover this entire nation's need for medicines and vaccines, and we could cover a significant portion of this nation's food requirements. And then on the flip side, we can be the ones developing the genetics to grow food outdoors. It is not our desire to eliminate traditional farming. It's not our desire to eliminate greenhouses. We want to make this supply chain as rugged as it can possibly be to increase access to foods and medicines. And I I'm ready. My brother is ready. Our business is ready to spend a decade, two decades on figuring this out, because what the heck else would I be spending my time on? This is the most important thing I could possibly think of.
Indeed, it really is. It really is. So one of the questions I get all the time from our students is, you know, how would they, if they wanted to go into ag tech or robotics or autonomous systems, how would they go about doing that? What are the classes or opportunities that you might recommend to them to help them best prepare for the future?
It all begins with fascination, obsession, passion. That's what it begins with. If you don't have that, you just won't be able to get through. You won't be able to do it in business. You won't be able to do it in sport. It'll be really hard to do in life. You need to have that fundamental drive. It's really, really important. So that's step one. Step two is just take step one physically, as in move towards your goal. Don't, you know, if you're thinking about, oh, I want to do this, oh, I want to do that, and the thing that's holding you back is, there are all of these ways that it could fail. Stop it. Stop it. You're going to be dead in 100 years. Stop it. You don't have time to do that. And by the way, in most cases, the fact that you are alive on planet Earth and you can communicate in a place that is safe with family members that you love, remember, the things that you pay least attention to are the things that you should be most grateful for. Electricity, light, your family. These are the things that you need to spend time being grateful for, because positivity begins with gratitude. But back to the question that was actually asked.
So that's so true, though. And that's such a key point. Having that positive attitude, it impacts everything else. It impacts everything else.
Well, you exude it. And I can tell you, you know, everyone who I've spoken to that knows JJ Snow has a glowing thing to say. but I think it's very, very important. I think a lot of people have misconceptions about business, as in you have to be this sort of ruthless maniac to push your business and its people as hard as they can possibly go in order to succeed. It's not the case. You know, there are success stories where that is the case, but it is not sufficient, nor in my opinion is it necessary. The positive attitude that our business exudes out into the market has allowed us to acquire the capital and acquire the people who can really make this mission true. But back to that question, what can you do? Take a step forward, get on the internet, watch YouTube videos, walk into that engineering school and more or less demand access to that engineering school. These are the kinds of things that will push your life forward and get you to the point where you need to be. When you're thinking, really use good judgment about how you spend your time, but always err on the side of action. I mean, I can tell you about the first moment of this business was a completely inconspicuous moment at a networking event where I spoke to a guy who was the presenter about, you know, I really enjoyed your talk. I don't really like networking, but I think it's really useful, yada, yada, yada. Right. And he said, go down and meet this tennis coach. And I'm thinking, oh, bloody hell, I've met 100,000 tennis coaches in my life. Why am I meeting another tennis coach? That tennis coach got me connected to Novak Djokovic. That tennis coach got me connected to Fred Luddy. That tennis coach got me connected to the current COO of our business. And all because I made the decision in the back right-hand corner of that room to say, all right, I'll go up and talk to the bloke. Why not? Why not? If not you, then who? If not now, then when? And so it's really coming back to that. It's really that mindset, because you don't know what's coming. I didn't know what's coming. Do you think I knew that I was going to be connected to Novak and Fred and the co-founder of YouTube? I mean, never in a million years. But you push and you exert positive energy and good things will come to you. Just keep prodding the universe. Otherwise, the universe will not respond.
Oh, that's so true. That's so, so true. And I can't even tell you the number of times when I've taken a call that other people don't want to take, and it has turned out to be the most amazing connection or the most amazing technology. Or so always, always take that opportunity, because the journey's worth it. The journey's definitely worth it. Exactly. All right. I've got one last question for you. One last question. I wish we didn't have to end this, because this is such a great discussion. There's so many other things I would love to ask. We'll have to have you back on again. So if you're coaching an aspiring innovator, what is one of the biggest pieces of advice, the best advice that you could give them as they start on their own journey? What is one thing that you feel that they just absolutely have to know as they're getting started?
One's hard. That's the hard part.
I know it is.
I think it would be one word. It would be go. Go.
Yeah.
Just go. Doesn't matter what's in front of you, beside you, who's behind you, who's above you, who's below you. Just go. Because if you are a relentless force, you will be exactly that. You will be a relentless force. So if you have a passion, if you have an idea, go. Guess what? 95% chance you're going to fail. So what do you revert back to? Go. Next. Good. Let's go. It's that mindset will not do you wrong anywhere. Doesn't matter how smart you are. I am not a particularly smart individual. I am an exceptionally normal person. My brother is not. My brother is a smart person. But what I'm saying is it doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what your background is, how smart you are. Just go.
I love that. I think that's a great high note to end our conversation on this time. Sam, it has been such a pleasure to have you join our show today. I am just really grateful for all of the insights that you shared and really excited to see what's next for the future of farming, ag tech, and what's going to happen with 1.1. So this is, you know, thanks to the Mentor Project, the ITSP Magazine folks, and Squadcast for making impactful innovations possible. And we'll tune in next time as we're going to dive into the incredible world of augmented and virtual reality with our next guest. So this is JJ Snow signing off with Sam Bertram. Sam, thanks again. And we'll be talking soon, everybody. Have a great day.
Thanks, JJ.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Impactful Innovations Podcast with JJ Snow. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.